morning. Is it Mr. Wagner?
It is. May I please the court, opposing counsel? My name is Aaron Wagner. I'm here before you today on behalf of my client, David Blair, who is with us today. This is an appeal from a decision that was made in the Sarpy County District Court on a motion that my client filed to intervene into a closed divorce case because he had obtained genetic testing that had proven or excluded, excluded nobody else but him to be the father of a child that was in the divorce case, adjudicated to be the daughter of another person, who was the appellee in this case, Mr. Lefebvre. The minor child's name is Aubrey. She was born on December 22nd, 2014. My client, admittedly so, knew that the mother was pregnant with a child, not necessarily his child. She doesn't know what happened. He doesn't know what happened, other than they must have had sexual relations at some point. But beyond that, my client doesn't know what else happened with Lefebvre, who I guess now known as Miss Wales. So at that point, she was engaged to be married to Mr. Lefebvre. This is in 2014, by the way. And they were married, Bryson and Isabel were married on September 28th, 2016. They were divorced that day. They were married on September 25th, 2014. And the child was born shortly thereafter during the marriage in December 22nd, 2014. After my client learned of the divorce, he got curious because he had heard maybe there were some issues with the quality of parenting that was being given to the child, and thought he maybe better look into this, better late than never, I guess you could say. And did so, and he talked to the mother of the child in February following the divorce that ended in November. So 3 months later, he talked to the mother about getting genetic testing. He had submitted his genetic material for testing, and the mother dug her feet, but eventually did so in August. On August 9th of 2017, my client obtained the results that showed he was the father, proved he was the father by scientific means, and hired myself. Filed a motion to intervene on September 14th, 2017.
Counsel, the statute 43-1412.01 right. Contemplates the filing of a complaint for relief. Does it make a difference that you filed a motion to intervene?
I would say you could call it a complaint or a petition or a motion, however so titled. Our effort was to intervene in the action to then eventually and hopefully, based on best interest of the child, set aside the paternity finding. We were unable to get that far because of our denial, which was based on a case, the Jeffrey B. case. It's a 283 Nebraska 940, wherein there was a biological father attempting to do something similar to my client. Although the party, I believe the child was born in 99 and paternity was established in 2000 or 2001, and this was in 2009. And they had said, well, you waited too long. You waited 9 years. And the basis of the court's denial of my client's motion to intervene is that he waited too long. But my client, if we're looking at the Jeffrey B. case, which said the measurement or the key factor was the length of time from the establishment of paternity to the effort to intervene. And if we're going to use that as the line, then establishment of paternity would have been when the parties were divorced in late 2016. And my client's efforts to obtain information to prove whether he was or wasn't the father began 3 months later, and his efforts to formally intervene in the case began less than a year later.
Wasn't there some factual basis in the record that your client actually was given some indication from the mother at the time she was pregnant that he might be the father?
Correct.
And does that figure into the time calculation here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could, Your Honor. I think it's a, if you look at the Jeffrey case, no. If you look at the circumstances of the parties, I don't know, everybody has different life scenarios that they find themselves in, and this probably, unfortunately, isn't all that uncommon that you might be told something. And I'm not a scientist, and I don't think they could have done any genetic testing or would have put that baby in the harm's way to find out necessarily at that moment in time if that was his child or was Bryson's child. And furthermore, the parties were in other relationships. My client's married now to his, at that time, girlfriend, and these parties were going to get married, and they did, and eventually got divorced 2 years later, which is when he kind of piqued his interest.
Does best interests of the child have any bearing on this case?
Yes, I think it does, because the statute itself says an individual may file a petition, complaint, motion, whatever you want to call it, to intervene if there is scientific evidence of his or her, his paternity. And it also says the court may set aside a prior finding of paternity, but the next sentence goes on to talk, the court shall appoint a GAL, which is a point in our brief and in our argument today that the court didn't appoint a GAL. The court simply, in conclusory, established that it had been too long, I think, again, in reliance on a case that was at worst 3 times longer of time between when that person had waited to come back and try to disestablish paternity as compared to my client. And furthermore, it didn't appoint a GAL, and a GAL would have been, should have been, because the statute says clearly a court shall appoint a GAL. The court should have appointed the GAL upon the motion or upon the petition filed by my client. And had that said that it wasn't in the child's best interest that he be, or that she be raised by my client, I guess that's an easier answer to swallow than can't even get that far, and you really want to do that.
The opposing party has raised a jurisdictional argument. Would you care to address that, please?
Yes, I would, Your Honor. We had filed, so the decision, the initial decision from the Sarpy County District Court was on March 2nd of 2018. And on March 9th, 2018, which was a Friday, to back up, the statute regarding the motion for reconsideration that we filed to toll the time of appeal says you have to file within 10 days of the initial decision. Initial decision was March 2nd, 2018. 10 days later would have been March 12th, if you count the weekends.
You were attempting, even though it wasn't styled as such, you were attempting to use a motion to alter or amend the judgment.
Yeah, we called it a motion to reconsider or vacate. And I think our motion contents is what's important there. And I think our motion was sufficiently styled to be that, asking for a completely different decision.
That motion was overruled by the trial court on March 13th?
It was overruled on March 13th because I had called to get a hearing date for our motion for reconsideration. Keep in mind, there was no motion day in Sarpy County at this time that said Mondays are motion days or whatever. There was none of that. And it wasn't just a common day for Judge Martinez to have a motion day. In fact, we had to call and get a hearing date, which is fine normally. We called to get a hearing date on March 9th, which was a Friday, before the Monday that the motion would have needed to be filed by. And we were unable to get a date because the court staff said they were unavailable to give us a date until Tuesday, which was the 13th. So I guess in an abundance of caution to protect my client's interest, I filed the motion, the very same motion that I had to refile on the 13th because it was denied before I could call that morning and get a hearing date on March 13th to then file a notice of hearing that would tag along with that motion that I had filed.
There is no dispute in the record that the trial judge's order denying your original motion to vacate or reconsider was entered, both signed and file stamped by the clerk before you filed your second motion.
Can you say that again? The original denial?
Yes. The denial that the trial court did on March 13th.
Correct. I received the denial on March 13th, and I immediately called to foreseeing this issue happening, basically. I immediately called and filed another motion. The same exact motion, nothing different, other than it had a notice of hearing that I was able to finally get on March 13th because they were back in the office.
Thank you.
Is this the rule or the custom that the motion not accompanied by a notice of hearing will be disposed of?
Well, I don't know that to be the case. I know that that was a rule, but the motion was accepted by the clerk and filed on the 9th, which I think, if you can relate back to that, which I think we should, that would toll the time for the appeal. That we filed our motion for reconsideration on March 9th. April 10th of 2018 is when the second denial came out of our on the merits of our motion for reconsideration, and then we filed our appeal on May 8th of 2018.
Your argument is that the March 13th motion relates back to March 9th?
I'm arguing that the March 9th motion, may I continue?
You may.
Was timely filed. And that that told the time.
But did you appeal within 30 days of the denial of that motion?
It would have been March. No, we did not.
And isn't that a problem?
I don't think so, because the March 9th, that it was a motion that was filed was a motion for reconsideration, asking for and falling within the statute that defines that motion. And from that point, the judge denied it because it didn't have a hearing date on the 13th. But I was unable to get a hearing date on the 9th or the 12th before the expiration of the 10 days. So again, I filed the motion as it was, fully expecting to call back on March 13th when I was told I could call back to get a hearing date. And it was denied before I could even get that. I guess my concern would be the alternative to that is I just throw down a date that doesn't make any sense and doesn't really, isn't on anybody's calendar or mine as to when this motion should have been heard, when no one would have known about it and it would have been a fake date. So I guess if we're, you know, I don't think the court would want to encourage people to do that just to, if I couldn't get a date, I had to file the motion within the time frame. I couldn't have gotten a date before it was supposed to be filed. So I did what was best for my client and filed the motion.
Thank you very much. Ms. Horst, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Heather Horst. I represent the appellee. Before we get to the substantive issues of this case, I do want to address the jurisdictional issues. We submit that this court does not have the jurisdiction to hear the appeal because it appellant's notice of appeal was not timely filed. As we discussed, the court filed its order dismissing Blair's complaint on March 2nd. Appellant filed his notice of appeal on May 8th. He argued that...
He filed not a notice of appeal, but a motion to vacate or reconsider.
He filed the motion to vacate or reconsider on March 13th. His notice of appeal was filed on
May 8th. I beg your pardon.
And the question is whether the motion to vacate the judgment filed on March 13th would have told the notice of appeal timeline. We submit that it did not. What's instructive here is the case of Heckman versus Marchio, which states that when the legislator fixes a time for taking an appeal, the courts don't have the power to extend that directly or indirectly. There's no statutory scheme here for extending the 10-day deadline for filing a motion to alter or amend the judgment as set forth in Section 1329. Therefore, even if appellant had a reasonable excuse for failing to file his motion on time, under Heckman, this court doesn't have the power to extend his deadline. Therefore, the case must be dismissed.
Isn't the linchpin to your jurisdictional argument that the district court actually denied the first motion and did so on March 13th. Had it done something else, like I'm not going to rule on this until you file a notice of hearing or something along those lines, we wouldn't be having this discussion, would we?
They did deny it and issue the order doing the same on the 13th. However, it was due to appellant's own actions and his failure to get a hearing date. And that's why I argue it does not extend the timeline for appeal.
So I think you're agreeing with my question, not disputing it, aren't you?
Correct.
When the district court reached the merits of what you're claiming was an untimely motion to alter or amend, the second one, did it effectively vacate its earlier decision?
No, it did not, because the earlier decision remained the same, and the earlier decision remained the final judgment.
I think perhaps Judge Stacy is wanting to query you, or I will, if she isn't, about the effect, if any, of the language in the second denial order that says, well, he filed it, this was sort of a redo of the original motion. What effect, if any, does that language in the second denial order have?
None, because this is a statutory scheme. The case law in this state is clear that the courts do not have the power to extend the timeline. Therefore, the court didn't have the power to extend the timeline regardless, because there's no statutory provision for that, to allow for that.
When you step back and assuming all of the discussion about how the courthouse is working, what are we to make of it, that an individual can't timely file a motion accompanied by notice of a hearing because of something that goes on in the courthouse, and therefore...
Well, that's what
therefore the courthouse
urges.
Isn't open, or what is the rest of the sentence?
Well, appellant urges that this mistake was due to the courthouse's, to what was going on in the courthouse, but the record is devoid of anything substantiating that claim. And he also believed March 9th was a Friday. Had appellant not waited until the last minute on a Friday, things might have turned out differently for him. But I believe part of the reason that he was unable to get the notice of hearing was because he waited until the last minute to file his motion to alter or amend.
Had he filed a notice of appeal within 30 days after March 13th, in other words, after the denial of the first motion,
the denial of the first motion,
he could have asserted error in denying the motion based on the absence of a notice of hearing.
It's possible. However, that's not why we're here. But if he had yet, then we might be arguing different procedural matter.
Would that be more promising?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Your argument is whether or not the trial court heard in the March 13th order or not, we don't have jurisdiction to decide that.
Correct, because the notice of appeal was not timely filed.
Before your time runs out, do you want to address the merits?
Yes. I do think what is important in this case is that the district court made its decision to dismiss appellant's petition or complaint, motion to intervene, whatever he titled it, due to the facts. The overwhelming weight of the evidence in this case only pointed to one conclusion, and that was that it was not in the best interest to vacate the paternity finding. He argues that paternity was established when they got divorced, but actually Mr. Lefebvre's name is on Aubrey's birth certificate. He was legally established to be the father by virtue of the marital presumption, but his name was in fact on the birth certificate. And I would argue that none of that even matters because he admitted that he knew about the pregnancy and the possibility of paternity before the child was even born. And he declined to act on that for approximately 3 years. And that was one of the deciding factors that the district court relied on.
Before you get to that point, there's an assignment of error that the court was required to appoint a guardian ad litem. Is it your position that the appointment of a guardian ad litem is discretionary with the trial court?
Yes, it is. The statute does include a mix of mandatory and permissive language. It alternates between mays and shalls.
But the shall falls on the guardian ad litem section of the statute, correct?
That is correct. But it comes after the first sentence of this statute, which says the court may set aside a final judgment. This court has previously interpreted that statute as giving the court the discretion as to whether or not to do that.
As to whether or not to appoint a guardian ad litem?
As to whether or not to set aside the judgment. And that's the interpretation. The interpretation the district court filed was based off of Alicia C. and Jeremy C. Now, I will concede in neither of those cases anybody raised an issue about whether or not a GAL was permitted. However, Judge Martinez's interpretation of this statute is really the only logical one. Otherwise, we'd lead to this bizarre result. In this case, the evidence overwhelmingly supported my client, and it was true. It's not disputed that he knew about the pregnancy and the possibility of paternity 3 years ago.
Could a guardian ad litem be helpful in determining the best interests analysis of the child? And isn't in fact that what a guardian ad litem would do if appointed?
If that was the case, then why would this court previously interpret that the court has the discretion to do the best interest of the analysis of the child? The guardian ad litem wouldn't have made a difference in this case because of the way...
How do we know that? If the guardian ad litem was not appointed, we don't know what they might have said. How do we know it wouldn't have made a difference?
Because the court was able to engage in the best interest analysis. And also, it wouldn't matter because under the other interpretations of the statute, Mr. Blair was guilty of an untimely delay.
Is there such a thing as harmless error in this area of the law?
I believe so, yes. The difference would have been the same regardless because he was guilty of an unreasonable delay. And it was clearly in the best interest. This is the only parent the child has known. Bryson had raised the child since birth. He is the custodial parent, which is worth noting. He's been the custodial parent since the parties got divorced. Mr. Blair did not allege that Bryson was in any way a deficient parent or a bad parent. In fact, he was content to let Bryson raise this child for the first 3 years of her life. While he waited until a more convenient time to assert his rights. Meanwhile, you know, he wasn't ready at the time the child was born, despite having knowledge that it could have been his. He wasn't ready to step into that role. He let Bryson do it. He didn't have a problem with it then. And that's what Bryson did. I think at this point, it would be very disruptive to the child's stability and mental health to rip her away from the parent she's known, order her to live with a stranger. Do you have any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on to...